Thank you so much for coming this evening. Thank you for your support of New Orleans, the founding era, and thank you to the Historic New Orleans Collection for inviting me here. It's great to see so many familiar faces in the audience. I'm going to start the talk by giving an introduction to the exhibition, and then we'll move into a more focused conversation about the role of Africans in the founding era and the role of Africans in the founding of our city. The ground on which New Orleans sits is perhaps most frequently associated with the city plan laid out by French engineers shortly after its founding in 1718. Though that regular grid of some 66 blocks gave shape to the area most modern-day residents and visitors to this city recognize as the French Quarter, the city's earliest documented residents were not French, but rather indigenous Americans. Native American occupation of this site, confirmed through archaeological excavations of pre-colonial Aboriginal pottery fragments and charcoal, evidence of cooking, dates to at least the century prior to French habitation. The exhibition New Orleans, the Founding Era, explores the early decades of New Orleans's existence as a French settlement and reflects on the complicated and often conflicted meanings the town's development held for individuals, empires, and Native American polities during the first half of the 18th century. In this exhibition, we encourage you to consider the ideas, peoples, and material cultures that shaped one of the most complex and challenging colonization projects in the Americas. Louisiana, in the second and third decades of the 18th century, witnessed an intense period of immigration, one that included the arrival of more than 6,000 French and German-speaking Europeans and a roughly equal number of enslaved captives taken from Senegambia, the Bight of Benin, the Windward Coast, and West Central Africa. Among those who survived the crossing and their initial exposure to the settlement's disease-prone environment were the men and women, children and families, engineers and bureaucrats, healers and builders who established the roots of a blended Creole culture that persists to this day. For many of these early inhabitants, whether their migration was forced or voluntary, New Orleans was simply home. For others, such as the Chickasaw, Natchez, English, and Spanish, our city's existence was further evidence of French encroachment into a changing landscape marked by shifting alliances and frequent conflict. This conflict meant that New Orleans and its surroundings served sometimes too as a place of refuge for runaway slaves, for orphaned children fleeing the Natchez Wars, and for the Petite Nation who settled near the town to escape Indian slaving raids. As a cultural, economic, and diplomatic crossroads, an entrepôt of both the Lower Mississippi Valley and the broader French Atlantic world, New Orleans was a settlement that did not fit easily within French imperial conceptions of what a colonial city could or should have been. Instead, it was a settlement shaped by a kaleidoscopic array of influences that stretched south from Canada and the Illinois country, north from the Caribbean, and east from West Africa and France. In 1717, the Company of the West, which was shortly thereafter renamed the Company of the Indies, and to which in this talk I will refer to simply as the Company to avoid complications, the Company received a 25-year contract to administer, populate, defend, and develop the Louisiana colony. In its 14-year tenure, the Company carried nearly 13,000 people across the Atlantic to the Lower Mississippi Valley. And this may not seem like a tremendous number of people today, but this is the greatest number of people brought to the colonial French world in such a short period of time in the entire period of French colonization anywhere in the Americas. Among those who willingly made the journey were concessionaires eager to establish tobacco plantations, representatives from Catholic orders, including Jesuits, some of whom brought their own slaves from places like Brazil, Capuchins, and Ursulines. There were also German-speaking families lured by company-sponsored propaganda, indentured servants hoping to survive their three-year labor contracts, scientists, craftsmen, and engineers, young women in search of husbands, and others. Approximately 900 of the people who arrived were soldiers, many of whom, if given a choice, would likely have opted out of a tour in Louisiana, as only 1 in 3 outlived their terms of service. Some migrants arrived as family units, but most, whether enslaved or free, did not. More than half of those arriving in the colony were sent against their will. Approximately 10% of those boarding Louisiana-bound ships in France were convicts, whose deportation was sanctioned by royal authority. Their crimes ranged from selling commodities such as salt or tobacco in violation of state or institutional monopolies, to prostitution and desertion, to being chronically unemployed, or in other words, poor. In 1719, the Crown, responding to company administrators' complaints about a dearth of willing migrants, it's hard to imagine, authorized the forced deportation of vagabonds and layabouts to Louisiana. The Crown's intent was twofold: rid France of what many considered the dregs of society, and create a captive labor force. This is the same year that the slave trade began. After little more than a year, though, the Crown reversed course, decreeing that, quote, no more vagabond smugglers or criminals be sent to Louisiana. Rather than becoming productive subjects on the other side of the Atlantic, many of the deported remained a nuisance and contributed to Louisiana's and New Orleans's unsavory reputation. This is an engraving from 1726, actually. It's an early political cartoon of prostitutes being rounded up in Paris and shipped to Louisiana. The single largest group of people brought to Louisiana, and the primary focus of tonight's talk, were the more than 6,700 African captives forcibly taken from their homelands and sold by the Company of the Indies as enslaved laborers. In the summer of 1718, the ship Aurore left Saint-Malo and sailed westward along the Breton coast. So here's France here. Saint-Malo is just on the north side of what is known as La Manche, or the sleeve that juts out into the Atlantic Ocean. At France's westernmost tip, At France's westernmost tip, the crew turned the vessel southward, skirting the Bay of Biscay before heading into the open Atlantic. Their primary destination, the slaving port at Ouida, located in modern-day Benin and shown here with this red star, lay at a distance of some 3,800 nautical miles from Saint-Malo and was the only open market slaving port frequented by ships belonging to the Company of the West and later the Company of the Indies. The Aurore's captain, recorded only as a Sieur d'Arpin, was charged with the first mission of its kind, the procurement of captive African laborers for the fledgling Louisiana colony. Ouida's traders supplied more Africans to the transatlantic slave trade in the first quarter of the 18th century than did those of any other African port. They did so in large part because, unlike in most other slaving ports where single European powers held regional monopolies, they had one-on-one agreements with local rulers, trade in Ouida was open to all. And this is a view from 1731 that shows the European trading compound at Xavier, which was the capital of the Kingdom of Ouida. The Aurore dropped anchor in the Bight of Benin just off Ouida's coast in October 1718. While Captain Arpin was negotiating with local traders for the purchase of more than 200 African captives, across the Atlantic, Louisiana's governor, Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne, Sieur de Bienville, was overseeing a motley team, Canadian and French soldiers and convicts, as well as enslaved and free Native American laborers. Lemoyne de Bienville was charged with clearing the cypress swamp where New Orleans would rise. Within a decade of the Aurore 1718 voyage, enslaved Africans would become Louisiana's favored laboring class, arriving in numbers that changed the colony's demographic from a society with slaves to a slave society. Arpin and his crew spent 6 weeks purchasing captives and provisions from Ouida's traders before sailing for Louisiana. After stopping for repairs and supplies, first on the Atlantic island of Principe and then on the Caribbean island of Grenada, the Aurora arrived along the Gulf Coast on June 6, 1719, nearly a year after its departure from France. The enslaved Africans disembarked from the Aurore were the first of more than 6,000 documented men, women, and children carried to French colonial Louisiana via the transatlantic trade. Approximately 27% of Louisiana-bound captives embarked from Ouida, which you can see here. Another 5% left from the Angolan port city of Cabinda in West Central Africa here. A far larger number, over 4,700 people, more than a third of the individuals brought to Louisiana during the French colonial period, boarded ships at Gorée Island, which, if you're familiar with modern-day Dakar, Senegal, I say that like Ophébia Quistarctin because I can. Dakar is here, and then off the coast is Gorée Island. Between Gorée and Saint-Louis, more than two-thirds of the enslaved individuals were brought to Louisiana. And that doesn't mean that all of the individuals were coming from these two outposts. They are being funneled from the interior to the coast. This is a close-up view, dedicates a map dedicated to the Company of the Indies that actually shows the area from which enslaved Africans are being taken from the interior to the coast. So this is the Senegal River, Saint-Louis de Senegal, which is the other major slave trading port for the French Company of the Indies for people brought to Louisiana, is at the mouth of the Senegal, much like we are near the mouth of the Mississippi River. So they're coming from the interior and being brought to the coast. To give you a sense of where this data is coming from, for those of you not familiar, there is a database that is invaluable for the study of the transatlantic slave trade. This is the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database. It's easily named, appropriately named. It's run out of Emory University, headed by David Eltis, and they have captured the data on more than 35,000 documented slave ship voyages to the Americas, so not just to North America, but also to South America and the Caribbean. And for Louisiana, we have pretty complete data for the French colonial period from, as you can see, 23 vessels. So you have the number of captives embarked from Africa. This is almost 7,000 people versus the number disembarked. And that reflects the mortality rate of the people being disembarked and the people who don't make the voyage. Average number of men, women, and children crowded onto slave ships during this period for Louisiana is 302. Average number arrive is 271. When we get down into other data sets, we have less information because ship owners and ship captains didn't always keep as careful of records as we as historians would like. So we know that the average mortality was 8.4% on voyages specifically to Louisiana. And this is considerably lower than other transatlantic slave voyages because the Company of the Indies incentivized the carrying of people safely across the Atlantic who made it alive. They gave ship captains a per head bonus for each individual who made it to the Louisiana colony. The average length of the Middle Passage was more than 8 weeks. That's an awful lot of... The Middle Passage is the crossing of the Atlantic from the time a slave ship left, not France, but the time a slave ship left the last port of collection in Africa to the time that it reached, for example, the mouth of the Mississippi. The average length was 65 days. The voyage of the slave ship Galatée was the deadliest of any Louisiana-bound ship in the French colonial period. In the exhibition is the original logbook. Recorded in its pages are the navigational instructions, the compass readings, the wind readings, the depth soundings from the ship Galatée. It's on view upstairs. The ship left France in May of 1728. The crew sailed south to Senegambia and spent nearly 4 months assembling a human cargo of 400 people during stops at Saint-Louis de Senegal and Gorée Island. Within days of their departure from West Africa, people began dying. Some succumbed to illness, but others, including two women, ended their own lives by jumping overboard into the Atlantic rather than face a life of enslavement and uncertainty in Louisiana. Another captive, one of five men caught attempting to steal from the hold, was hanged from the ship's yardarm. By the time the ship arrived at the mouth of the Mississippi River on January 18, 1729, 82 enslaved men, women, and children, and 11 crewmen had died. Their deaths were recorded in the margins of the ship's log, all along here. These are marginal notations. The Galatée's mortality rate at 20% was more than double the average for slave ships traveling to the colony in the 18th century. When the first Africans were brought to Louisiana, and indeed throughout the French colonial period, the port of New Orleans played a secondary role for the arrival of slave ships. Because fully loaded ships sat too deep in the water to pass the shallow depths at the mouth of the Mississippi, most vessels engaged in the transatlantic slave trade anchored not at New Orleans, but rather in the Gulf of Mexico. So you can see here, this is the mouth of the Mississippi River. This is an area known as drowned land because it was so marshy. Here's the Mississippi River here, and you have the sounding depths. This is where most ships are entering. This is the Southwest Pass. This is still the pass that's most frequently used. But in the 18th century, there were no jetties. There was no dredging. And so ships would anchor off of the mouth, and then they would unload everything and go upriver, lightened. From these anchored vessels, arriving Africans, weakened by malnutrition, disease, and surely heartbreak and terror, were loaded into large pirogues, or ship's boats. And you can see an example of one of these in the foreground of this 1731 watercolor. These ship's boats were often manned by other enslaved Africans owned by the Company of the Indies. A team of enslaved sailors rowed each vessel ashore to the small island outpost known as the Belize. And you can see the Belize, this little island here, at the mouth of the Southwest Pass. At the Belize, they were met by additional Africans owned by the company who helped settle the newcomers into temporary shelter. Much of the labor required to transfer cargoes of enslaved captives or goods from arriving ships' holds to smaller transports was performed by the more than three dozen captive adults assigned to the Belize's commander and his enslaved African overseer, Joli Coeur. At least eight of these men, including Pierrot, Solange, Moreau, Quant-à-moi, Louis, Maurit-Ambara, Comba, and Guigny, are identified in a 1731 inventory as matelot. Does anybody know what matelot means? Seamen, sailors. They were part of a larger group of company slaves tasked with working on the colony's waterways. Enslaved sailors made up 17% of the company's enslaved adult population, with 13 of them assigned to approximately half dozen small boats based in New Orleans, 7 to the Natchez post upriver from the capital, and 9 to the governor's plantation. Given the nature of maritime work at the Belize, these men likely performed labor roles that were very similar to that of canoemen along the West African coast, a resonance that must have seemed striking to arriving African captives who found themselves shuttled both on and off slave ships from opposite sides of the Atlantic by skilled African seamen. In addition to the sailors, there were 38 other people, enslaved people, residing at the Belize in 1731. There was one slave driver, 7 skilled men, including 2 carpenters, a tailor, baker, and a nurse, 14 male unskilled laborers and 10 female, and 6 children ranging in age from 3 months to 6 years. Or to put it differently, to put the presence of these Africans in other words, there were 19 single men and older adolescent boys, including the healer Magnon and the laborer Mori Tambara. There were 10 married couples, including Louis and Mary Gomi, and Moke and Moge. And there were families. Pate and Samba lived together with their 4-year-old son Dominique, Momorou and Wari with 8-year-old Jeannot, 2.5-year-old Marie-Thérèse, and their newborn daughter. Overseer Jolicoeur and his wife Renee had 2-year-old Suzanne. And boatman Contamois and his wife Gaimin had a little boy named Jean-Louis. By the mid-1720s, this community resided in thatched huts on a neighboring island that was accessible to and from the Belize's main island via a wooden footbridge. Turning back to the voyage of transatlantic vessels engaged in the slave trade, however, arriving African captives bound for New Orleans did not linger at the Belize. After a brief rest, captives and overseers took to the water once more, this time to face the arduous, exhausting final leg upriver about 100 miles to New Orleans. Traveling this last stretch, which could take a week or more, was made more difficult by the weakened and often sickly condition of individuals who already had been at sea for months. On arrival in New Orleans, those who had survived the Middle Passage and the journey upriver were taken first to the company's plantation across the river from New Orleans. How many of you live in Algiers? Anybody live on the West Bank? So the company's plantation, which is seen in the foreground here, and here's a better picture of it, this is pretty familiar territory. This is where the French Quarter now sits with St. Louis Church in the center. But in the foreground, you have a depiction in the 1726 watercolor of enslaved laborers owned by the Company of the Indies who are clearing the site at the company's plantation. So when they arrived, if they survived, they were taken first to this site, to the company's plantation across the river from New Orleans. There, those suffering from malnutrition, fevers, yaws, which is an infection of the eyes, and other illnesses received treatment at the company's hospital. If they survived, most were then sold either on site at the company plantation or across the river in New Orleans. The majority of enslaved Africans were destined to live and labor outside the colonial capital, in tobacco fields near Natchez, on indigo and rice plantations up and down river, on small farms across the Mississippi Valley, and along the colony's numerous waterways. Yet there were other occasions, many occasions, when men, women, and children of all ages owned by colonists, military officers, religious orders, and administrators outside the settlement were brought to or had business here. From its earliest days, New Orleans was a crossroads, a place situated in the deep bend of the Mississippi and accessible from both the river and nearby Lake Pontchartrain. Enslaved boatmen navigated this watery landscape, bringing goods and people to the marketplace. African draymen, including those who were among the 38 people owned by colonist Charles de Meuron, carted slave-made bricks from Meuron's brickworks to construction sites strewn across recently cleared land. And African women surely joined Native Americans and Europeans in peddling provisions grown on nearby farms. There were other occasions, too, when Africans not living in New Orleans found themselves in the settlement. In 1728, the Louisiana Superior Council, the colony's judicial body, mandated that every slave-owning colonist provide labor to public works projects for a period of 30 days per enslaved person annually. This mandate, known as corvée, brought many enslaved men and women into New Orleans each year, where they were put to work building and shoring up levees, clearing land, and maintaining drainage canals. On this 1732 map of the settlement, we can see this small structure on the outskirts of town just next to the communal mill where the arrow indicates basically where Harrah's is now. We can see a small structure on the outskirts of town, and this is described in the map's key as, quote, a large hangar or shed serving as lodging for Negroes working in the city. This is where corvéed laborers slept, in a covered agricultural shed that likely resembled this one. As you might imagine, the types of labor enslaved people engaged in during corvée were some of the least desirable. Hard labor led to injuries and exhaustion. Exposed and cramped living quarters and questionable provisions placed laborers in a precarious state, vulnerable to spreading sickness and infections. Some men engaged in corvée never made it back to their owners. This was the case with Alphonse, a man owned by a Canadian officer, Charles Petit de Levilliers. In April of 1730, Alphonse fell ill while working on the drainage ditch intended to encircle the settlement. After a brief hospitalization, he died. His owner, we know this because his owner, having lent him to the Company of the Indies for public works projects, sued the company to have him replaced because they had lost their investment. Whether Petit de Levilliers, the owner, was successful or not is unclear. For Alphonse, an African man with a Christian French name, his life ended here, just blocks from where we sit today. It's likely that he was buried in New Orleans' first cemetery, a place we'll come back to in just a short while. While many enslaved Africans living and laboring outside of the colonial capital came to New Orleans to trade, to labor, or even to socialize, whether in sanctioned visits or not, they were also brought here to engage intimately with the institution French colonists held most sacred, the Catholic Church. Article 2 of the Code Noir, issued by the Crown in 1724 and intended to regulate treatment of the enslaved in French colonial Louisiana, states, "All slaves in our province shall be baptized and instructed in the Roman, Catholic, and Apostolic faith. We order the inhabitants who purchase newly arrived Negroes to have them baptized and instructed within a suitable amount of time under penalty of an arbitrary fine. We enjoin the directors general of said company and all our officers to uphold this order precisely." Many slaveholders, including Bienville, followed these strictures. As surviving baptismal records make clear, in fact, Capuchin fathers from the St. Louis Church spent more time baptizing enslaved men, women, and children than they did any other group. The earliest extant baptismal register from St. Louis Church shows that Fathers Raphael, Hyacinth, Pierre, and Philippe administered baptismal rites to 555 people in the three-year period between January 1731 and December 1733. This included 178 free whites, 2 free and 7 enslaved American Indians, and 1 free and 367 enslaved Africans and African-descended people. That's 66% of all baptisms performed at St. Louis Church. At this high percentage, enslaved Africans and their children born in the colony represented by far the largest segment of the colonial population to undergo the baptismal rite. On April 12, 1732, here's an example, Father Raphael baptized 8 men and 4 women. Each received the sacrament, and in doing so, took a new name, furthering the process of cultural separation forced upon them by the slave trade. Relinquished, or at least set aside for private use, were names like Komba, Baraka, Gaymen, Fatima, Gu, G, Semba, Komba, and Nagu. All were replaced with saints' names, Louis, Arnaud, Jean-Baptiste, François, Marie, lots of Maries, Anne, and Genevieve. Adult baptisms represented approximately 16% of all baptisms conducted in the colony and accounted for 24% of those administered to enslaved people. The remaining 76% involved children, many of whom were born here. Whether parents witness their children's initiation into the Catholic Church is unknown. Official church records document only the presence of slave owners and godparents, who in the French colonial period, especially the early French colonial period, were often friends or relatives of the child's master. This does change during the Spanish period. It is difficult to say how deeply or how quickly Africans in Louisiana, men and women whose own cultural and religious backgrounds were incredibly varied, embraced the teachings of the Catholic Church. Evidence from the settlement's earliest cemetery suggests that here in New Orleans, as in many other colonial contexts across the circum-Caribbean world, Catholicism played a significant, though perhaps not an exclusive role in shaping the belief systems of Africans and their descendants. We're going to shift for a second. In 1972, how many of us were alive in 1972? Okay, I did not raise my hand. In a pattern that would be repeated in 1984 and in 2011, construction workers digging in the block bounded by Rampart, St. Peter, Burgundy, and Toulouse streets unearthed numerous coffins, human bones, and burial goods, including clothing, shoes, and jewelry. Archaeology, with the help of archivists and historians, and of course, the Archdiocese of New Orleans, determined the site was home to New Orleans's oldest cemetery, St. Peter Street Cemetery. How many of you have never heard of St. Peter Street Cemetery? Okay, good. I'm glad there aren't more of you. Shown on early maps and established in the early 1720s, so concurrent with the establishment of our city, St. Peter Street Cemetery was the city's only recognized burial ground until the 1790s, when St. Louis number one is constructed. When St. Peter's closed around 1800, burials were left on the site. Eventually, the entire block was covered over with residential and commercial structures, things like P&J Oysters and condominiums, and I think Funky Butt used to be in that block, but I can't be sure because it was a long time ago. And they were here. You've all passed this square, and this is from 1725. Eventually, the cemetery covers this entire block. The two religious artifacts depicted here were recovered during a construction project and subsequent archaeological excavation at St. Peter's Cemetery in 1984. Both of these objects were worn by an African man in his 40s who was buried at St. Peter Street Cemetery in the mid-18th century. We know this is an African man rather than an African-descended man born in the colonies because the man's teeth were notched in such a way to suggest Central African origins. This is a ritual shaping of teeth, sometimes known as country marks, which are more typically ritual scarification, but there's also a changing of the dental palate. This man's Catholicism, testified to by his presence in a Catholic cemetery, and the adornment of his body with a rosary, crucifix, and religious medallions, was not unusual for African or African-descended people living in 18th century New Orleans. In fact, the majority of burials recovered from St. Peter Street Cemetery during archaeological excavations in 1984 and 2011 were of African and African-descended people. And if you've ever seen the movie Poltergeist, you might have an understanding of what this process was like. Literally, people who own condominiums, most recently it was the Marinello family in 2011, they went to put in a pool, literally like the movie Poltergeist, and they hit coffins. And the state was called in, as was the UNO archaeological team, along with Earth Search, and they were able to, thanks to the property owner's consent, they were able to map these graves. This cemetery served as the burial ground for all Catholics, including European and European-descended individuals and Native Americans, regardless of race, ethnic origins, or condition of servitude. The settlement's first census, recorded in 1721, documents the presence of 171 enslaved Africans in a total civilian population of just under 500 men, women, and children. So less than half. Nearly 10 years later, New Orleans was home to nearly 900 civilians, of whom 252 were classified as enslaved individuals of African descent, because typically the enslaved population is being dispersed. There is a concentrated population here in the city. In New Orleans, it's generous to call it a city, but in the settlement, there is a concentrated population of Africans, but most of the enslaved population is in the outskirts, in the plantations. Neither of these early censuses records the presence of free Africans or free people of color in New Orleans or anywhere else in the colony. Yet other records, including those of the Catholic Church, the Company of the Indies, and the Louisiana Superior Council, testify to the presence of a small and growing community of free blacks. And at least one African woman, a Senegalese woman listed in company documents as Marie Baud, La Femme Pinée, arrived directly from Senegal as a free woman in 1729, bringing with her three people she claimed as her own property. She traveled willingly to New Orleans, where she joined her husband, a French gunsmith named Jean Pinet, who'd been exiled to New Orleans for a murder he had committed while living in Saint-Louis de Senegal. Others, including a man known in company documents as Louis Congo, earned their freedom. In Congo's case, his freedom came in exchange for his agreeing to serve as the settlement's executioner. For both enslaved and free Africans residing most of the year in New Orleans, labor defined much of their adolescent and adult lives. Some men and women came to New Orleans with skills honed in Africa, including metalworking, carpentry, healing, food preparation, midwifery, and crop cultivation. Others learned new skills on arrival. European craftsmen, from coopers and locksmiths to sailmakers and joiners, had also migrated to New Orleans in its early years, often under the sponsorship of the Company of the Indies. But their numbers were small, and they were never sufficient to meet the colony's needs. As soon as Africans began arriving in Louisiana, colonial administrators, company officials, and colonists began training enslaved men and women in new and specific skills, sometimes placing them in formal apprenticeship agreements with European craftsmen. And a word about this document that I keep coming back to. In 1731, when the Company of the Indies withdrew from Louisiana, they essentially said, this is not working for us. Crown, you may have this territory back. When they handed off the colony to the king, they took an inventory of everything they owned, from bowls and spoons to people. And so this is a comprehensive list that details in great specificity the people who were owned by the Company of the Indies, their relationships to each other, their values, their skills, and their families. Also noted is when people were sold on behalf of the company. So you see here, this is an apprenticeship section of that inventory, which is more than 20 pages long. And you see a man named Lalime, who's apprenticed to Le Duc, the locksmith, Domingue and Gratifère, which is interesting because Gratifère means tool sharpener, are apprenticed to an edge tool maker named Bonnet, Etienne to Ozen, the cooper or barrel maker, Belle Humeur to Canot, the blacksmith, Moussa to Becquet, the locksmith, Telmac and Rabot to a woodworker, La Rose also to a woodworker, La Fortune to Delatte, L'Éveillé to Sautier, who's also a woodworker, Pierrot to a roofer, Laurent to Chevalier, the locksmith, Dubout to Blampin, the carpenter, also Diamant, and another L'Éveillé to Durivage Maison. And I know it must seem tedious to listen to a list in that manner, but we have so few details about the individual lives of the enslaved that I think it's important to speak their names. As noted earlier in the context of enslaved men working in the colony's waterways, Africans were not tied exclusively to land-bound endeavors. Dozens of men based both in New Orleans and directly across the river at Algiers Point served as sailors, rowers, and river pilots, shuttling goods and people to and from this place. In a letter to company directors written in March of 1729 regarding maritime labor, the governor, Étienne Perrier, and local administrator Jacques de Lachaise proclaimed, quote, "We are putting in as many blacks as we can in the place of white men." The 252 African and African-descended people living on the east bank of the Mississippi River within the bounds of New Orleans' original footprint represented less than 30% of the settlement's total population in the 1730s. But at the 400-acre plantation just across the river, there were an additional 154 enslaved people. So I like to see the city and the plantation as a unit, because truly they are connected. There were 154 people living on the West Bank plantation. The company was the largest by far slave owner in the colony. Many of them traversed the river on a regular basis to train and labor in New Orleans. Of the 129 adults who lived on the West Bank, they lived in 32 small cabins. These were 13 foot by 21 foot cabins on the West Bank in 1732. Just over half of these adults lived together as husband and wife. This number would have been much higher had the sex ratio been more even, but with 2.5 African men to every one woman, African men faced serious challenges to family formation. The vast majority of women owned by the company in the colony already lived in domestic partnerships with enslaved men. And within those family units, nearly half had children. And of course, the status of those children followed that of their mothers. This is the system of matrilineal descent solidified through the Code Noir and other legal codes operating throughout the Americas. The role of African and African-descended people in the development of early New Orleans society was formative. Their labors, clearing the land to allow for growth, raising the levee to protect against flooding, making the very bricks, shingles, and foundations used to construct permanent structures, shaped our physical landscape. Their knowledge of rice and crop cultivation, building methods, and healing helped sustain and shelter the settlement's early inhabitants and their cultures. Their cultures of survival, of resilience, continued to mark and mold the city nearly 300 years after their arrival. Thank you.